at the time, and Rabinowitz was on the bench, and we were experimenting with the number of people to come in as we had a tremendous caseload transferred over to us from the feds. We're having ongoing cases that had just come up and they needed to be disposed of. There was a fella came up from outside by the name of Bob Elias, E-L-I-A-S, from the King County Prosecutor's Office that was going to give us a hand and also to see if he wanted to stay with the court, with our court system. Former Justice Irwin was also here in the office for a while. And this I'm getting two cases confused because of the circumstances and the type of the incident. There was a lady had shot and killed the fellow she was living with. He was a native woman. And she probably wasn't, you know, like 85 pounds dripping wet. Circumstances of the shooting were not known because nobody else was present, although they found the body, and she admitted doing it. For the longest time, they couldn't find out where she shot him. They found a hole in his throat, but they could never find the bullet. I mean, not never, but for a long time, they didn't find the bullet until even x-rays didn't reveal it. But apparently, it had become lodged between two interspaces of the, or an interspace in the spinal area, but it severed the spinal cord and the person expired, the person that she shot. She had been arraigned before. I remember being at the arraignment when she was, after she'd been indicted, and before Judge Aaron, and we were in the old federal court building, and she was brought up, she was in handcuffs, Judge Aaron was had read the indictment. You know, asked her what her name was. I can't remember what the lady's name was. He asked her, "How do you plead, guilty or not guilty?" And she didn't have an attorney with her at the time. And she looked kind of puzzled. And she said, "If you mean, did I do it or not?" She said, "I did it." And Judge Aaron entered a plea of not guilty and appointed, I think, I'm not sure if he appointed Fred Crane or my dad or some arrangement like, but he appointed one of them at least to represent her. Well, time passed and we didn't have the 4-month rule in, and we went to trial. I was in there to help. I'd assigned Bob Elias to prosecute the case, and Bob was an experienced prosecutor. We sat at the and I was there to help him pick the jury. I wasn't going to stay around for the case because I had a lot of other things to do. We used what was at that time, had been up to that time, the U.S. Magistrate's Office, or U.S. Magistrate's Courtroom, and it was a kind of an elongated courtroom, and the jury box was on one side, and because the room was rather narrow, they had this kind of an L-shaped, boomerang-shaped table. And it was all one unit. It was like maybe, well, if you straighten this out a bit more, that there was, you know, two chairs here and two chairs here, and they were kind of halfway facing the jury box and halfway facing the bench, and with the chairs behind it, that being the arrangement, and then the spectators and everything were in back of this general arrangement of the jury of the counsel table. When they came into court, my dad and Fred Crane were representing this lady. Sooner or later, her name is going to come. But and she's very, like I say, she's a very tiny person. And she was sitting on the far side, like she would be sitting here. And I'm not making this clear for the record, but she would be sitting to the extreme right. And the prosecutor, myself, I was here. Bob Elias was here in this corner, and then it was, I think, my dad, and then Fred Crane, and then this lady. And whether it was set up like that by my dad and Fred Crane. I'll never know. It was just happenstance. That's the way it worked. But they were pretty experienced trial lawyers, and they tried. I'm sure that you know that they would. Well, they were advocates. That they started off the case like this, and I think Judge Rabinowitz was pretty sure he was the one on the bench at the time. The declaration was made as to the case and who was there and who represented what. And then at this point in time, my dad or Fred Crane Fred, no, my dad asks Fred. I think Fred was supposed to represent her, and my dad was helping Fred. That's the thing of it. My dad asks Fred in a very loud stage whisper, which was not a whisper, but loud enough so everybody in the place could hear it, what is our client's name? And the rejoinder to that was, I don't know. What is she charged with? Then the next thing that happens after this bit of an exchange, and they're both looking around, they're trying to get Bob Alias's attention, you know, and do you have a copy of the, do you have an indictment for us? And he's flustered because he's never had this kind of an experience before. He's really going to get whipsawed. He didn't know it at that time, but he was. He finally finds a copy of the indictment and gives it to them. And the next thing they ask him for, could we borrow a legal pad? All they had in court with him was a client. And whether, you know, how much of this was for stage effect, and I suspect a lot of it was, but the state's theory of the case, of course, was that it was a straight out-and-out shooting. You know, that she had, that this lady was... Had become disenchanted with her paramour and shot him. And is it time? Okay, let me know. The defense theory was based on two theories. Fred defended the case on the law of the native, and my dad defended the case on the law of the jungle. And the fact that that she had shot and killed this fella was in both the defense theories that she was justified in doing what she did, and the jury acquitted her. I'm not kidding. And Bob Alias was staying with me at the time, and my family had gone. I think it must have been in the summer, but my family was gone, and both former Justice Irwin and Bob Alias and myself were all staying at my house. And Bob Alias, when he came in at night, he would just roar with, you know, just telling us what had happened, you know, during the day of this trial. And I could believe it was going on because I'd been with with these two guys in court, and I knew what they were capable of doing. But he meant, you know, about the law of the native and the law of the jungle, and he had no defense. He had nothing to, you know, to protect that or to go against those two defenses with. I'm sure there are, you know, a lot of other vignettes, but I guess my problem right now is that I got to get back into court.
No, just
put it on stop. It's going.
Watch the red line, too. Make sure when you talk in there that it registers.
It seems to be it moves over about halfway between the little bottom line and the red line.
That's fine.
It's
good.
It's moving anyway.
Good. Okay. I wanted to ask you about, why did you come back to Fairbanks to practice?
Well, my dad was here, and I wanted, it was a good place to come back, you know, to start practicing.
Uh-huh.
I knew I wanted to go in, you know, since I'd gone to law school, it was logical to go on to practice. And since my dad was in, some people don't do that, you know. it was a good place to come back and start to practice.
Mm-hmm. Who else had gotten their start in your father's office? I talked to Bill Boggs earlier today. He said that a lot of young lawyers
yeah,
got their start in your father's office.
Like I say, when Gene Miller was in the office when I got here, he'd graduated the year before, Bill Baugus had been there, George McNabb. Oh gosh, I can't. Jay Lathan was in there, but that Jay was in there, you know, early after the war. Of course, George McNabb and Bill Baugus came along. It was after the war too.
Mm-hmm. List of people.
When I got here, Judge Pratt was on the bench, and shortly after that, he retired. I can't remember exactly when, and Judge Forbes was appointed. And Judge Forbes was, I guess you had to call him a carpetbagger because he came in from North Dakota or someplace like that. Was appointed as the federal judge here, and he served for about, I'd say probably about 9 or 10 years, up until 15 years.
What was Pratt like as a judge? Do you remember?
I remember Pratt as being pretty old, when I remember seeing him. And I was in court when he was on the bench, but I never did a case before him. But I say the transition about the time that I came on and he left was pretty darn, you know, pretty close to the same time. And at the time I remember seeing him, I remember green eye shade. He had in his chambers, he had a roll-top desk, you know, tiny roll-top desk. And he got around, it seemed like to me he was very careful about how he got around, you know, he wasn't very active in AGM.
What about Forbes? What was he like?
Very sociable person. Extremely nice person, and ran a good court. I think he's very helpful to a young lawyer. Mm-hmm. Some of that I can't remember some of the law clerks that he had. I think Charlie Cole was a clerk with Forbes, I think. Barry Jackson may have, is Barry's name on? Barry Jackson's name is not on here. Mm-hmm. Barry Jackson is a person that you might want to talk to. I mean, at least, to, you know, to have a name and some a name there at, thinking about him. Barry Jackson, clerk for Forbes, I'm pretty sure. You know, and I don't even know if Pratt had any clerks or not. I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out. Sherman Noyes was in town the other day. Sherman lives in down out of. Out of Delta Junction, about 25 miles, and it's a little bit south of what they call it, where the peak down there is called Donnelly Dome. And Sherman's been down there, gosh, has it been 10 years or more? He's kind of reclused, was doing a lot of artwork. He gets some kind of cockamamie ideas from time to time about different things, and he's come in twice, and he tells me about these things, and it's about he's going to run for president. This time he's going to run for president of the United States so he can tell people things. He's got a plan to, what the hell is a plan? And it was something, you know, when the first time you hear it, you know, you kind of cock your head a little bit, you know, and you think, you know, is this guy Section 8?
Is he out of town now? He's not in anymore?
No, he came in to get his supplies. He says he comes in about once every 6 months. But he says the cabin is very accessible, and I'm sure I haven't been down that way for quite a few years. But
what about Bill Baugus? Was he Fred Crane is on that list or not? But he worked with your father for a while.
Yeah, Fred worked with my dad, and Neil Canelli, I think, was maybe the last person that might have worked with Fred, and. I see you have Fred down here twice, as a matter of fact. That's what kind of a character he was. I had heard a story about Fred that and I'm not sure which judgeship it was, but that Fred was very intelligent and a good lawyer. But he did like the bottle. And I'd heard about Fred, that he had been being seriously considered and probably the leading candidate as a federal judge in the territory. And either to celebrate the possibility that he might go on the bench or whatever, but he went out on a big drunk, and they immediately withdrew his name. And but for a long period of time, Fred may have been suspended for one reason or another, and I suppose that somebody would have information about why. And then he was reinstated, and then practiced in the last couple until the time he died.
Do you know how he got reinstated?
Pam, I'm not sure if he was reinstated before or after statehood. I kind of think it was before statehood. Fred and I did a couple of cases together, and if Fred was working with my dad on that case, I told him that was Mary Tyndall, was the lady's name. If he was working on that case, then he had to have been admitted before statehood. So his readmittance must have been made, sometime prior to that. I don't know when. But.
Do you think your father had him? Someone had told me that maybe your father had helped get him reinstated.
Probably did. My dad was like that kind of a person. He was willing to help, anybody. Mm-hmm. Anybody that needed help, and he'd do it. Dad had a gold bug that was just fatal, in the sense that he was fatally bit by a gold bug that... anybody come along with mining prospecting, my dad was into it, And unfortunately, poor old soul, he had invested in a mine across the river and up in the foothills of the Alaska Range, and years and years and years, and fought the elements, trying to get people to go in there, and people, it was a good mining district back in the early days when it first opened up, and people would go in there and they'd hoodwink him, and maybe they'd take out gold, maybe they wouldn't, and he never did really get a payday out of it until he died here a couple of years ago, 2 years ago in August. And my sister and I are the heirs only heirs, and the estate is still pending, and the mine is actually, or the estate being open, the mine is, you might say, being operated out of the estate. And we finally got a payday. I just think, up there, aren't you looking down here, looking at this gold finally? But that's he's not the only one that had the gold bug as far as the lawyers are concerned.
Who else did?
Oh, I think E.P. McCarran McCarran was interested in gold mines. I think McCarran to the point probably of not of actually going out and mining and prospecting and things like that, but having interests in gold mines.
Did people take gold mines as payment for work done?
I think that they probably did, sure. Gold up until, until a few years ago was $35 an ounce, and it'd take a lot of gold to make a payday. But then when the lid, when the ceiling went off of it, they unfroze it, but gold went, really rocketed, and people that had mining claims were making big money from them.
Any other miners that you remember?
Miners?
Yeah, made money off mining, or you had interest in claims?
Oh, I'm sure that almost anybody that had a working claim and worked at it made money. Mm-hmm. They had to, otherwise they wouldn't go back year after year. You can't afford to, so you have to believe that they're making money. They're making gold. They're probably selling enough gold to pay expenses and then, putting the rest aside. People that had gold when $35 an ounce and when the ceiling went off of it, they became four, eight, 12, 16 times as wealthy by the virtue of it. Let's see. Put some of these names down here. George Eggers in Anchorage now, practicing. George had a drinking problem. Very good lawyer. Very good lawyer, but his drinking just was not suitable for, you know, his practice. Just couldn't hang on to it. I understand Walter Scudlow's name is down here. And Walter doesn't really practice. I don't know. I haven't seen Walter for a number of years, but he has the first federal savings and loan. And I'd heard when Walter took the bar that he knew the code, like that last ACLA, the blue set up there,
yeah,
word for word. Is that, you know, that kind
that's
of
right,
a,
yeah,
intellect. E.B. Collins was not really actively practicing when I came here. Collins and Clasby was the partnership, and Mary Alice Miller went into that partnership as a, I don't know, an associate or whatever. It was never Clasby and Miller, it was always Collins and Clasby. Mm-hmm. And Collins either died, retired, or something, you know, shortly, within the short period of time after I got here. Because I remember a retirement dinner for E.B. Collins, at which time the bar, I can't remember how large the bar was, but there was the country club out on Yankovich Road. I'm pretty sure that that's where it was held. It was a nice place. It's since burned down. They never did really, they built up a, I don't know, kind of just a clubhouse, you know, for golfing, but it's not for meals and stuff. But they had a real nice clubhouse and a dinner and like that. And the speeches, as I recall, it was in the wintertime and the doors were all closed and getting hot and all those things. People were dozing off. And E.B. Collins was asleep half the time. But he must have been in his 80s anyway. But they were going to make a presentation. And this is something that my dad did. I don't know if really can be too proud of him for this, but he did it anyway. But somebody was giving E.B. Collins a watch, and the speeches had gone on, you know, talking about how good E.B. Collins was for a long time until the guy got up to give him the watch, and everybody knew that, you know, he'd hold a watch out there, and he'd say, and I give you this, and then he'd start off and, you know, and talking about it, something else. And this is where your oral history comes in, you know, talking about these things, raconteur, ad nauseum. And after an interminable length of time, my dad said in a loud stage whisper that everybody heard, he says, 10-1 he doesn't give him the watch. That just broke the house down. But that was E.B. Collins. Walter Hodge, I remember Walter from, he was practicing in Cordova. And, but he came, he was a little later as I recall, and, no, he was Hodge in, when did Hodge go to Cordova?
It would be there in the 40s.
See, I wasn't there in the 40s. I remember when he went on the bench, I can't remember where I was, nor where he was, but he asked me, he wrote me a letter and asked me if I wanted to take over his practice or whatever. I can't remember when that was. Well, I seriously considered that because I, you know, hometown, you know, and roots and all that stuff. And I really felt good about that, but of course I didn't do it.
Was it when your father was in Fairbanks already, when he offered you the Cordova practice?
I'm sure, because I would have had to been in practice at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would have had to been back here. There was a fellow here, Jack, or Cornelius P. Coghlan, C-O-G-H-L-A-N. When I got here, they called him Jack, mm-hmm. Jack Coghlan. Jack had a practice and doing quite well at it. He got involved. He was skirting. He was on the in the getting in the gray area from time to time, and people knew it. Jack got a side of now his son practicing in Southeastern. He was a federal judge from Juneau. Tough guy. I mean, has a reputation. Tough judge.
In Juneau now?
His son is in... I think his son is in Haynes. Let me shut this off. It won't waste your tape. Okay. That Cornelius Coghlan was being prosecuted in this for something, and I'm sure that there's got to be a record on it, and I'm satisfied that he was convicted of whatever he was charged with. And then they proceeded to, because he'd been convicted of a felony, and that then they were going to disbar him. Come to find out, he'd never been barred. For some reason, he'd either falsified or, you know, had been...
And Fulton was the judge?
And Fulton was the judge at the time. And that's when the courts were doing the disbarment proceedings. Mm-hmm. There was no bar association and such. And the courts did it. But I remember that it was that he did not have a he was not admitted to practice law in the state of Alaska. And here he was. And, you know, there's one of your lawyers. You know that is not was practicing and he's but not admitted.
But he was known for not being a very good lawyer.
Well, but that, you know, but even that type of a person attracts a clientele.
What kind of clientele would he get?
He'd get people that felt that they did, that maybe that he wasn't going to charge him as much as another attorney. Mm-hmm. You know, one that, I would assume that that's what would maybe go to somebody like that. Or, mm-hmm. or maybe, you know, now I guess we call them third world people, you know, that they're not just the, you know, maybe not on the straight and narrow, somebody that wants maybe a lawyer that maybe looks a little shady or something. And figure if they go to an honest lawyer, if there is such a thing, they're going to be run out of the office or somebody, you know. I'm sure there are a lot of people that need lawyers that are not on the up and up. That the client is not on the up and up, and they want a lawyer that they feel they can have better rapport with. Coghlan may have been one of those persons, and I'm sure we've had others come through the bar. I don't know whatever happened to him after that, because he was, of course, he was, since he was disenfranchised, whatever you do to somebody like that.
Did the DA bring the charge against him, or did the judge just...
I think the district attorney did. They brought all of that stuff. You mean about the disbarment or the criminal
right,
matter?
The disbarment.
Somebody must have preferred the charges. You know, assuming that there was a conviction, and I have to believe that there was, he would have had to have been, somebody would have brought the charges before the court, and that's when the matter came to a head like that.
Yeah. Did Fulton come up very often? Did judges bring?
No, it seemed to me like Forbes. Things are going awfully slow here. The town was getting busy. Things are really jumping. There were getting more and more attorneys, but we only had one judge, and it was really a bottleneck. Mm-hmm. And the calendar was terrible. One judge doing everything, and I could understand it, because I've been, from time to time, maybe about once a year, I may be stuck here for a week by myself, you know, and you just... Oh. You know, like Everett Heppe used to say, like being the owner of a sick goldfish, you know, you don't know what to do. Forbes, I'm sure, did everything humanly possible, but he's just one person. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, a visiting judge would come through and really clean house. Judges from the Ninth, usually from the Ninth Circuit, would come up and raise particular hell with the local bar, thinking we're all a bunch of ruffians. But all the divorces were handled, and divorces back the, in that day were not as easy to get. You had to have a 2-year residency period, you know. Which, you know, when you think back on it, it was some kind of Victorian, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but the divorces would pile up, you know, there'd be hundreds of them. And the visiting judge would come in, you know, and clean out all the divorce calendar. Civil docket was, it was absolutely staggering. And the criminal cases, when I took over this, the district attorney's job here, and we took the, we transferred the criminal files, we had 300 to start off with. 300 pending criminal cases. We immediately had to, you know, we knew physically it's just impossible, couldn't have ever tried them. So we went through and very carefully sorted as best we could, you know, and disposed of as many, you know, just by dismissing them, because we, there were a lot of weird charges to the, there was a lot of forced prosecution by the federals on thing, you know, what like they call them, what now, crimes of non or victimless crimes, you know, gambling and prostitution and things like that. So a lot of that stuff was dismissed. The heavy duty cases, of course, were retained. We did prosecute them.
Which ones did you consider heavy duty?
Well, you know, murder and rape and robbery and mm-hmm. burglary and cases like that.
Was there an effort before statehood, was there a vigilante type of effort under part of the DAs?
From time to time there would be. I think we're the bar recognized that, you know, as far as the, depending on who the DA was, and that they would have, you know, impanel a grand jury and you know, hip pocket grand jury and get all the indictments through that they could, and then proceed to lose all of the cases, you know, because they were badly conceived, they were sometimes trumped up charges, and everybody knew that the prosecutor could go to the grand jury and get an indictment anytime he wanted on anything against anybody. And oftentimes would, and so the end result was that the jurors were you were usually working with a jury that had been around for a while, because they were required to serve a lot longer than they are now, and they got wise to the system, and there were a lot of acquittals, you know, and they realized how shoddy the cases were. You know, I guess even in after statehood, you know, I'm sure that from time to time that in an effort to clean things up, the police, you know, may initiate it and then bring the cases to the prosecutor, who will examine and say, yeah, I think you got a case there. Mm-hmm. But then realize, you know, that the police maybe have dropped the ball at that point. All the police were interested in were getting in the indictment, and then not follow it up with good investigation, and then you'd lose the case and went to trial. The police were not ready. And you lose the case. I don't know how much of that goes on nowadays, because I don't find, since we're not plea bargaining, I don't. And every once in a while, the case is dismissed. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's that many. I think that they're a lot more careful about what they're doing.
Was there, you can talk both before statehood and after, were there efforts by the community, did they support this kind of, was there pressure on the DA to clean up?
Well, some of the social things like gambling and prostitution, slot machines, mm-hmm. things like that, they cracked down real hard on that. For some reason, and I guess maybe it was the proximity of the military bases, and maybe they got pressure from the Department of Defense or something like that to do those things, to make a better app, you know, better town in which the military people could come in and spend their money, rather than get fleeced, you know, by whatever gambling or whatever, and so that there seemed to be always a lot of activity, you know, by the U.S. Marshals and the police in cracking down on those elements.
Did you ever have trouble with juries, the grand juries? Was there ever, in early days, grand juries wouldn't convict on alcohol crimes, prohibition crimes. You just couldn't. there's nobody.
I don't know. That's, you know, I suppose there's part, you know, you're going to have to go back further than I'm aware of as far as Prohibition days are concerned.
Yeah, well, yeah. I was trying to, was there anything, a parallel in the 50s at all, where there was no way you would get a conviction in a certain area or for certain people?
No, no. The it used to be said in Barrow, and maybe some of the other villages, maybe like Fort Yukon and places like that, that you would never have conviction. You would never have a native convicted in a village.
Mm-hmm.
And that may have been true at one time, but it's not true anymore.
But in the 50s, would it have been true? Were there cases out in the villages?
Mm-hmm. Very rarely. Very rarely. There were no courts set up as such. I suppose even there may have been more federal courts now than there were then. Or there are more federal courts then than there are now.
Mm-hmm.
The trials were all held prior to statehood. All of the district court trials were held. I don't know of one that was held out of Fairbanks. I know that they in South Central, out of Anchorage, they had trials in Cordova, I think,
mm-hmm.
Several of the southeastern towns had federal court buildings, like Ketchikan and Juneau, and they probably didn't have the geographical area to cover. But I'm thinking that we didn't have a trial. I don't remember a trial of a district court nature out of the city of Fairbanks.
Really, none.
Now I remember going to Fort Yukon for a district or a magistrate's trial.
Mm-hmm. Was it commissioner's court?
Or commissioner's court,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
What kind of trial was it? What was it? Or hearing? What was it?
It probably was something, probably a bootlegging case,
mm-hmm.
as far as I can remember. I know I went over on it. The U.S. District Attorney went over. I'm not sure if we picked a jury or if we ended up dismissing the case or whatever. I don't think we actually went to trial, but they were prepared to do it in Fort Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't. Now, as far as Barrow is concerned, I don't know when the first trial might have been held in Barrow. That'd be interesting too. There are people. I suppose that, like Sadie Neacock, who still lives in Barrow and very active, should be consulted, because Sadie was a magistrate at that time and at statehood, and she would certainly know a lot of, you know, if there's any legal history in Barrow, she would certainly know it.
How do you spell her last name?
Neacock. Neacock. She would probably be able to, would know too as to what, you know, who might have conducted the first felony trial up there.
Yeah.
I had a case, it's been a couple of years ago now, that's a reported case in the Alaska Reporter. It involves two of the families, the Browers and the, I can't think of the name of it, but Charlie Brower had two families. And, gobs of children, and when he died, he left a will dividing the property in a certain fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a contest. Many he died like in 49 or something like that. And it was just then there was some dissension amongst the children about how the property, the residual property or something like that, how it was to be divided. And so some of them filed suit against some of the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go to, I went to Barrow to take the testimony of the case. And there's your oral history, you know, about how Charlie Brower got started. He came up from San Francisco and working for this trading company, and then when they were going out of business, he bought some of their properties and then started up his own business and married the Eskimo girl from the community there, and you know, it was how the property was developed, how they went whaling and stored the boats, you know, and bought the food. It was pretty neat. That took about 3 days to do that. But Sadie was the would be a, that person that would be able to tell you something about Barrow. Mm-hmm. Then there's a little lady down in Nora Gwynn in Bethel would be able to tell you about Bethel. Now Bethel is for a long time was served out of Fairbanks. It's still part of the fourth. It is still the fourth judicial district, but the trade lines always followed the rivers, the paths of communication. Ted McRoberts is still alive. Ted is a former U.S. Marshal, and unless last time I saw Ted, I think he's still probably mentally aware and aware enough to discuss these matters. But Ted is an old timer that lived down in a place called, I think it was Takotna, down on the Yukon, T-A-K-O-T-N-A. And Ted did a variety of things. I think he printed a newspaper, and he was a U.S. Marshal, and I can't remember, a bull cook, and knows a lot of the history of the river country. He came to Fairbanks and went to work as a deputy U.S. Marshal, and was a deputy U.S. Marshal for many years. And retired maybe, I guess Ted has probably been retired for 8 or 10 years now. His brother is retired and lives, his brother's name is, I can't remember what his first name is. But he's he was also in the U.S. Marshal's office, and I don't know if he had the same, did all of the things that Ted did. I know that Ted was quite active. Ted Lowell still lives here. L-O-W-E-L-L was U.S. Marshal, was in the U.S. Marshal's office. Frank Chapados, C-H-A-P-A-D-O-S. Frank Chapados was a U.S. Marshal and now is involved in the H&S warehouse. He and Judge Hepp, I think, were partners or associates in that business.
I was going to ask you about lawyers in business. Did most of the lawyers who were practicing in Fairbanks also have businesses on the side or do other sorts of business or supplement their law income?
I don't think so. I don't know. Unless they, of course, they might have been silent partners in something, but I think most of the attorneys that I see on your list here didn't have other businesses, and I don't think they really would have had time for it.
So they could make enough money practicing
law. Yeah, maybe they were clipping coupons off of stocks or something like that, but no, I think that they were probably pretty much supported by their law practice. And maybe they had investments, but I seriously doubt that they had other businesses going.
Were there any firms besides the Cole and not Cole, Collins and Clasby? And was Collins and Clasby the only firm?
I can, if you're starting way back. At what time?
As far back as you can remember, were there any other firms? Was it all solo practitioners and people coming in and out of the offices as associates?
Seems to me like there must have been. Uh, must have been sole practitioners with, you know, with somebody, an associate or something, with, without changing the name. But I remember Collins and Clasby. I think that that's something more of a more recent origin, you know, having a larger multi-attorney firms. I don't, you know, on this list there are a lot of attorneys in, but it seems to me like the list is far from complete.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of other people who should be on it?
That's what I'm trying to think of. And I'd like to think of some source that, short of going back and, you know, maybe the library and getting old phone books or something like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, while you're thinking, were there meetings at the bar?
Oh, yeah, the bar was very active. And, they would the bar, by and large, met at the Model Cafe, and usually met at the Model Cafe at least twice a day, once for breakfast and once for lunch.
Twice a day?
Well, there'd be so many, you know. I mean, it was so convenient, and most of the attorneys were congregated on Second Avenue, or, you know, were reasonably close by. That the Model Cafe was a great place to go, so they would. They had a room in the back of the Model Cafe that they use for, you know, when you have a lodge meeting or something like that. Well, the bar would meet there, and I think it was on one afternoon of the week.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, in the morning, you get there in the morning, and there'd be, you know, a number of booths taken up with lawyers and sitting at the counter, and then noon would be about the same way. You know, we'd have lunch at the. This was a small town then, and the town was. You know, hadn't spread out like it is now with the outlying shopping malls and restaurants, you know, strung out in different places. There weren't many places to go, and you didn't have time to hop in your car and go someplace. So the Model Cafe, the co-op had a lunch counter in it,